Hi, Patrick here at Big Show headquarters in Boston with a newsy pod. We have 5 language-related stories from the past month, picked by Carol and me. We'll hear about a new charter school in California where you can learn in Punjabi. Also, the unofficial language of many parts of Nigeria. The golden years of French. Annoying Americanisms. Well, some may actually not be Americanisms at all. And some disastrously bad translations. Okay, well, cartoon queen, Carol Hills, you're here again.
Great to be here, Patrick.
And you're fresh off the plane from Florida, right?
That's right.
What were you doing down there?
I went to the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists annual convention. But at that convention, there was a group from South Asia and across the Middle East, the Arab world, basically. They're brought there by the State Department. And they were selected by the State Department to come over and learn about cartooning. And so one of the places the State Department brought them was this convention so they could rub elbows with other with American cartoonists. Needed interpreters for most of the people from the Arab world, Arabic interpreters, and most from South Asia, of course, speak English, the link language of that region. It was great, and I found myself asking the group of Arabic-speaking cartoonists who are from everywhere, from Algeria to Bahrain to Jordan to Gaza, can you guys understand each other? And they said yes, but there was a lot of regional variation. And they said, you know, there's modern standard Arabic, so we all sort of get it, but there's a lot of regional variations, and a lot of times, I don't know what he's saying.
Right. Right. So they kind of flipped to modern standard Arabic, which presumably takes an awful lot of the nuance out of what a lot of them may be saying.
Yes. And the interpreters that the State Department had were Lebanese, or Lebanese of Lebanese descent. They were mostly Americans of Lebanese descent. And
were there complaints about the Lebanese-centric translations?
No, they all seemed to be having a grand time. But I was also interested to see to what degree their cartooning was based on captions and words versus pictures. I would say even in their own cartoons printed in Arabic that they're more picture-centric.
Right.
And what's interesting is their impression of American political cartoonists in terms of their work was that their role is kind of to make Americans laugh, where the cartoonists from the Arab world and South Asia, it's serious. There's real political issues and there's real kind of strife. So they feel like they're dealing with much more important issues.
So
it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, more editorial.
Yes.
Very interesting. Okay, so Carol, you have story number 5.
Yes, I do. And it is about the first Punjabi language school in the United States. It's a charter school. So it has the imprimatur of public education, and it's opening in Sacramento.
This fall.
Huh. Yes. It's primarily Sikhs, and there's about 40,000 Sikhs in the Sacramento Valley. There's a couple hundred thousand in California as a whole. It's sort of interesting on a number of levels because it reflects a sort of aspirational population that wants to preserve its language, that's proud of its language, but it's also clearly met and passed a lot of local approval. Any charter school needs to go through 8 million hoops to get approved. The U.S. compared to Canada has not nearly as many Punjabi speakers, but it's a sort of sign of the times about preserving language among younger generations, about a lot of, you know, sort of the educational kind of reform movement, which charters are a part of, taking on language as sometimes one of their marquee items.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's interesting about this is Punjabi, as you say, I mean, we don't think of this country as having that many Punjabi speakers. Canada has more, Britain has more. I've actually just come back from a trip to Britain where one of the stories that I reported that's going to be on the Big Show, and also I'll put it on the podcast, is about Sikhs and about the Sikh civil rights, surrounds largely the wearing of the turban. It's in the section of Birmingham, Britain's second city, and there was a school opening this fall, a Punjabi school, public school opening this fall. So, and of course, that in Britain, that is not the first. But funny to hear about it here in the U.S. too.
Is it in the same context as the U.S. school in terms of within the fold of public education?
It's public education, but because over there isn't a separation of church and state or religion and state, they don't need to worry so much about that. So it's actually associated with, I believe this is true, associated with the House of Worship, which is right across the street.
That's interesting, because I naively assumed that the lack of separation of church and state in England was Christianity, and it's not. It's
no.
just that you can...
Yeah, there are Muslim schools.
Yeah,
Christian schools, Muslim schools, and they are public schools.
Well, the other piece of this story is we moved to Canada, which has a larger Sikh population. 300,000 Punjabi speakers in Canada. In the course of the past 30, 40 years, we sort of had flip-flop immigration policies. And when they were taking in Indians, we were taking in Pakistanis, vice versa. So one sign of Punjabi being an important part of Canadian life, first of all, it's now the fourth most widely spoken language in Canada after English, French, and Chinese. Mm. And a sign of that, a sign of true integration in Canada, is that there is now an announcer, a Punjabi play-by-play, several Punjabi play-by-play announcers for Canadian hockey.
That means you've made it in Canada,
you
right?
You have made it. And what was funny on the blog, there was sort of a blog talking about this, and somebody wrote in, "Don't you mean field hockey? Sikhs don't know about ice hockey. Maybe it's field hockey that they're talking about." Somebody writes in, "No, it's ice hockey. Come on. We're not idiots." So let's hear a bit of play-by-play in Punjabi.
Yeah. ਤਾਂ ਜਦਕਿ ਸਾਰਿਆਂ ਵਾਸਤੇ ਬਹੁਤ ਵਧੀਆ ਤਾਂ ਜਿਹੜੇ ਵੀ ਬੰਦੇ ਜਿੱਦਾਂ ਕਾਰ ਤੇ ਜਾ ਰਹੇ ਹੁੰਦੇ ਜਾਂ ਟਰੱਕ ਤੇ ਜਾ ਰਹੇ ਹੁੰਦੇ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਵਾਸਤੇ ਬਹੁਤ ਵਧੀਆ ਉਹ ਆਨਲਾਈਨ ਜਿੱਦਾਂ ਆਪਣਾ ਸਾਰਾ
ਓ ਯਾ ਯਾ ਦੈਟਸ ਅ ਗ੍ਰੇਟ ਮੈਸ਼ ਅਪ ਆਫ ਕੈਨੇਡੀਅਨ ਐਂਡ ਨਾਨ ਕੈਨੇਡੀਅਨ ਸਾਊਂਡਸ
ਬਟ ਇਟ ਸੀਮਸ ਆਲਸੋ ਲਾਈਕ ਅ ਟਿਪੀਕਲ ਇਮੀਗ੍ਰੈਂਟ ਗਰੁੱਪ ਡਾਰਨ ਇਟ ਵੀ ਆਰ ਗੋਇੰਗ ਟੂ ਬੀ as X as possible, in this case
right.
as Canadian, so we're going to learn to play hockey, even though it has nothing to do with where we came from.
Right. Yeah. That's a great one. Okay, number four is, you know, you might think this is a bit of a throwaway story, but it's not really. A translation firm in the UK have put out something that is very popular on the web, and you can find a whole bunch of these things, which is a top 10 translation blunders. We all have a lot of fun at this. I tweeted this story when it came out. It's fun, but there's a serious side to it. There's some jokey ones here, and we can talk about them. But there's also a couple of really, really serious ones. They actually cite a case of an overdose of radiation treatment that some people received in France as a result of a translation error from English into French. There was a transplant in Germany that went all wrong as a result of a translation error.
Wow.
So, you know, they're making some serious points. But, of course, the reason that people like to hear about these things are, for example, a new toothpaste in France, which is called Q, C-U-E. Q. I don't know. Is that how you say it in French?
I don't know.
Or QA? Yeah, the accent is not here in the English copy, so I'm not sure. But anyway, that happens to also be the name of a porn magazine in France, which probably means the toothpaste didn't go down very well, or maybe it went down extremely well with a certain section of the population. I don't know. A lot of these are to do with, you know, products. There's another. Now, this is, I think, an English pen or at least English language company that then had its marketing or its advertisements translated into Spanish for its new Mexican customers. And it sold the pen as one that would not leak in your pocket and therefore embarrass you. But they thought the Spanish word for embarrass was embarazar.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that that's the word for impregnate. So you put this pen in your pocket. Here's another one. There's a company in Sweden called Electrolux.
That's what's familiar here.
They're quite familiar. Okay. Well, they apparently have not sorted out some of their English language marketing, because here in the United States, they described a vacuum cleaner as, this is what it says, "Nothing sucks like an Electrolux."
That's great.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a great pun if that's intended.
Slogan.
I'm not sure if that was intended. Then there's the old Pepsi one, which Pepsi does not like to talk about, apparently. When they were in China, they translated the expression, which I guess was an English little catchphrase that they were using, "come alive with the Pepsi generation." But it ended up in Chinese as "Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the grave." Which, if it does, again, you know, yeah, there is a segment of society that would be very interesting.
Drink it.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Or to pour it on your ancestors or what have you. I don't know. You know, they're fun, but it makes a very serious point about the fact that mistranslations are. I think that this company is really saying, don't do Google Translation. Not yet, okay? Don't Google Translate. Don't
use it without a second pair of eyes and getting, maybe use it initially, but don't start a whole marketing campaign
Absolutely.
With your Google Translate.
That said, it strikes me that a lot of these examples were human errors as opposed to, just sticking something through an online translator.
Yeah.
It's just what we do on a daily basis. And boy, we've all done it. So that's story number four. And you have number three.
All right. I've got story number three, and we're going to start by listening for several seconds.
Okay.
Yes, Obala, Obala, on you cool, I'm down with it under my voice, and that is song of NG weighing back to my head. Enjoying body sing that one. I believe it by now. All the children don't dance belly food because they know the level now. Time don't reach for them to begin their yarn their mind. And not only for Wazobia FM now, they give children chance to yarn their own. If
it's called, okay, so you're testing me here, Carol, right, as to what this language is. I can make out a lot of English, but it's not just English, that's for sure.
No, it's a Nigerian pidgin, and that is Radio Wazobia out of Lagos, which started in 2007, is incredibly popular, and now they're setting up satellite stations in Abuja, Port Harcourt, other parts of Nigeria. Mm. And pidgin is, like other pidgin languages, it's considered the great equalizer, and it's a way for Nigerians who occupy one of the most intensely multilingual chunks of earth in the world. I mean, there's an estimated 250 languages, 521 dialects.
Wow.
It's just intensely multilingual and just how history happened there. And so this serves a really important purpose. And it's sort of considered a default language because English is the official language. It's one of the official languages. And other major languages, Hausa, Yoruba, Igbo, they've been neglected in the educational system. So pidgin has taken on a more important role. These other major local languages are being neglected in terms of teaching them in schools and having them as major languages. What I find interesting is the sound and cadence of pidgin, because the nature of it, it's used a lot by sort of shopkeepers, working class people in markets and things like that.
Much more spoken than written, presumably.
Yes, yes. And it sounds sort of so laid back. It's like these languages, you sort of can't imagine some scientists using it.
Right.
It's sort of inherently casual.
Right. Is it truly a pidgin? You know, some of these languages that are referred to as pidgins are not in fact pidgin, and that they have developed into a Creole. They have more of a stable grammar than strictly a pidgin does.
This one, if you look into explanations of it, it says it is not a Creole. It's not considered a Creole language because most speakers are not native speakers. It's an acquired language. It's also called pidgin or broken.
So if it's an acquired language, that presumably it changes dramatically from one generation to the next.
Well, it's actually hard to say here. I see sort of two different things that contradict each other. It said it's not considered Creole because it's not the speakers are not native. But then it says that Nigerian pidgin is the native language of approximately 3 to 5 million people and a second language for at least another 75 million.
Sounds like a lot of people, most people use it as a second language, and so therefore, but a lot of those people would presumably understand English too because there's so much English in it.
Exactly. And there are regional differences within pidgin. You know, a Yoruba speaker has different words for this or that, an Igbo speaker. I found a little Nigerian pidgin lesson. Let's just listen to it.
Welcome to a quick guide to Nigerian pidgin English. How buddy? How you day? This means how are you doing today? How far? This means hey or hi.
Okay, that's a little easier than the radio station.
Well, when you listen to her explaining this means that, you can tell how much it's borrowed from English, but you can also hear the sounds that are obviously from local languages.
Yeah. In many ways, it's easier to understand it. When presented that way, it's much easier to understand the English dialects. So this station is, it sounds like it's popular beyond expectation.
I think so. I think they're really surprised. And I think a lot of it seems to be that it taps into kind of what's real on the ground versus what is imagined or hoped for.
Mm.
That Nigerian pidgin is a very, many, many millions of people are really dependent on it and use it. And so it reaches a lot of people and speaks to a lot of people.
I remember doing a story on, was it Singlish, which is not a pidgin, but a kind of mashup of various languages that are spoken in Singapore. And the Singaporean government is extremely opposed to Singlish, despite the fact that it's very, very widely used. I wonder what the Nigerian government thinks of
I think it's pidgin. Similar. They won't make it an official language. Mm. There are a number of official languages. Pidgin isn't one of them. And this is true among other governments, that where in governed countries where pidgin is popular, they just don't want to make it official. I think it feels too raw or somehow conceding failure on their part.
I wonder if they have regulations for the radio station, you know, like if, for example, there are news bulletins at the top of the hour or something like that, whether that would have to be read in one of the official languages.
It's entirely pidgin.
Whole thing, huh?
Whole thing.
Mm. Well, party on in pidgin, huh? That's great. Okay, well, story number two is on one of our very favorite languages, French. We've done, you know, lots of hits on French and its decline over the years since its glory days. And I really didn't know that much about the glory days until I read some reviews of a new book that's just come out by, what is he? He's the head of the Académie Française, I believe, Marc Fumaroli. This is a book called When the World Spoke French. This makes me want to read the book, I must say, reading these reviews. I mean, there's some magnificent history and also anecdotal stuff about some of the people who spoke it as well. You know, we hear again and again about how French was the language of diplomacy back in the day. And what I didn't know was how it became so widely spoken in Europe. According to this book, it was after the end of the 30 Years' War. The Sun King, Louis XIV, was in charge of France at the time. And in 1685, he made what, according to this book, was the worst political decision of his life, which was that there had been on and off discrimination against the Huguenots, the Protestants. But at the time, there was a ban on discriminating against them. He revoked that ban. He was like, have at the Huguenots. And what happened was the Huguenots left France, which was a bit of a blow economically and otherwise to the French. But what it meant was that they then spread the French language across the capitals of Europe. It was a very strange, I mean, you think of a language being spread across, you know, non-native parts as being a kind of colonialist move. This was the opposite. I mean, these people were
expelled.
Were, if not expelled, were escaping discrimination. And
wow.
So, yeah. Yeah.
But why do the receiving countries accept the language?
Well, I think there was a high proportion of intellectuals among this refugee class. They were just high status people. And as a result, the French language took off in
That's
this.
Amazing.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? So anyway, this book, 95% of the references, the likes of you and me, Carol, are not going to get in this. I mean, it's this is pretty highfalutin stuff. But there are some great.
It's not written in Nigerian pidgin, is it?
It's written in whatever the opposite of Nigerian pidgin is. But there are some great portraits of individuals. There's one woman cited who was, she had a great name, Charlotte Sophie Doldenburg, who was the Countess of Bentinck, born to a branch of the royal Danish family. She never set foot in France, but she spoke perfect French. This was classic for the time. I mean, she was a countess, you know, what else do you speak? She corresponded with Voltaire. She rode horses and wrote about it in French, etc. And rode like a cavalryman, it says here, well beyond the age of 30 when you're supposed not to be doing things like that. Had lots of flings and etc., etc. She is, you know, one of many examples cited in the book as somebody who benefited from speaking French insofar as French encapsulated this, quote, unique alliance of intelligent power and insolent joie de vivre.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
so
amazing.
Of course, French isn't what it was. History happened in the same way that history happened to kind of kickstart it.
But wherever the French have been historically, they leave their mark.
Boy, do they.
I mean, they're there for a half hour, they leave their mark. I mean, it's like, you know, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's Vietnam, whether it's Egypt, I mean, they make an impression. Aspects of their culture are carried forward, whether it's in buildings, whether it's in certain cultural things like the novel. I mean, it's sort of amazing. It obviously reflects the status of the language. Let's face it, it's a beautiful language.
Absolutely. I wonder how long the language will last now in some of those places where the French, because there still is, you know, very much Francophone parts of the Arab world, as you mentioned. It's funny, in hearing all of the news coverage of the events of these revolutions and stuff, you know, Tunisia and places like that that were French colonies, you know, I heard a huge amount of English. Of course, I'm hearing English language coverage, but you get the sense that some of the youth there they're making choices about their second language that may not
include French. Yes, it will be
interesting. Yeah.
I mean, in Vietnam, I mean, now it's probably people in the north over the age of 50 or 60 speak French. And I remember when I was, you know, in college, a lot younger, and I was traveling what was then Eastern Europe, and still people at that point, German was their second language, a holdover from the Habsburg Empire. But I'm sure that's gone now.
Well, there is a little bit of good news for French that I saw a story in the Toronto Sun that said that, of course, French is highly protected in Canada, but French immersion programs at public schools in Ontario have become extremely popular of late. So there's an awful lot of Anglophone, English-speaking families who have decided to send their kids to immersion programs in French. It could be as a result of the recent research into the bilingual brain, how it gives you an edge, or it may be an interest in French language and culture. But it's French may be dwindling in its influence, but it's not going away.
Well, I think in Canada, it's still a requirement for federal jobs. I mean, I think at least nominally being bilingual. So I think there's still a reason to have French in Canada because of the language laws.
Well, vive français. Okay, Carol, you have story number one.
Story number one comes from a headline, "Why Do Some Americanisms Irritate People?" So I was all excited about this. But I've decided that the person who is all up in arms about this, he himself is irritating. But anyway, let's just get to it.
And what nationality would this man be?
British.
And so, of course, when he says people, he means British people.
Yeah.
Why do they irritate people?
Yeah, he should say, why do some Americanisms irritate me? So anyway, okay, here's a simple sentence. I have had a lengthy career in journalism. I hope that's because editors have found me reliable. I have worked with many talented colleagues. Sometimes I get invited to parties and meet influential people. Overall, I've had a tremendous time. Okay, in those few sentences, here are the words that really annoy him. Lengthy, reliable, talented, influential, tremendous.
What on earth is the matter with any of them? I mean, I grew up in England and I use them all the time. I don't know what he's talking about.
Okay, and he quotes the poet Coleridge denouncing the word talented as a barbarous word.
Coleridge is dead.
I know. That was in 1832. What is wrong with these? Okay, a letter writer to the Times, you know, the London Times, in 1857 described reliable as vile. What's so vile about reliable? Oh, get over yourself. Okay, he says, the alarming part is that it's starting to show in the language we speak in Britain. American usages no longer swim to our shores as single spies, as reliable and talented did. They come in battalions. So he thinks that British English is being attacked by Americanisms.
Hmm.
He says, I have to agree to a license spelt with an S. I'm invited to print something in color without the U, you know, because without the U in color. And then email, it's never the more natural British term, e-post. Oh, who says e-post?
Oh, for goodness
sake. Come on. Okay, I'm sitting here in the U.S., but who would say e-post?
I think he's having us on or something. I mean, this is absurd. The thing is that Brits do love to blame everything on the Americans when it comes to language. But the thing is, who's using that stuff? It's Brits. They need to blame each other, if anything. And another point is that when I was over in Britain, I also met up with and interviewed something I'll put in a future pod, Lynn Murphy, who is an American who teaches linguistics at the University of Sussex in Brighton, and she maintains a very good blog about the difference between English and American English. What's it called? Separated by Common Language. I think it's called Separated by Common Language. And she has pinpointed several expressions that the Brits blame on the Americans as American imports, and they're not. there's one that says, have got, which I think they've got confused with have gotten, which would be an American import, perhaps, I don't know. But the expression got or have got, it's British.
Listen to this guy go on. In the course of my own lifetime, countless routine British usages have either been superseded or being challenged by their American equivalents. We no longer watch a film, we go to the movies. We increasingly have trucks, not lorries. A hike is now a wage or price rise, not a walk in the country. Okay, here's a list of ugly and pointless new usages that appear in the media in Britain and drift into everyday conversation, according to our irritated writer. Phase. As in, it doesn't faze me, hospitalize, which he thinks is a really vile word. Wrench for spanner. Elevator for lift. Rookies for newcomers. And starting to creep in such horrors as ouster, the process of firing someone. An outage, meaning a power cut. I've always read that as outrage. Come on, get over yourself. And he goes on and on about apartments rather than flats, freight trains rather than goods trains. Anyway, so that's our guy.
And of course, here in the newsroom, because we're part of the BBC, we get an awful lot of British wire services, etc. And we always have a good old laugh. I mean, you listen to the BBC and we have a good old laugh about lorries and stuff like this. And I find myself sort of hopping back between the two cultures and the two versions of the language and all of that. And if you can't laugh about the difference and not get too worried about the import. I mean, look, goodness, both countries give each other a ton of words. And the exchange is more fluid right now because of the internet. I mean, lots of Americans read British websites just as Brits read American websites.
And I just have to close with this memory from the early years of our show, the big show. Famous, famous disagreement between the London staff and the Boston staff over how to pronounce the person I know is David Bowie. This was a huge fight. Okay. All you Americans out there, you know that we call him David Bowie. They insisted, our British counterparts in London, insisted that we pronounce it David Bowie, because that's how it's pronounced in Britain. And we kept saying, if we pronounce it Bowie, we will be laughed out of the country. It's Bowie. And they were really serious and really upset. It was just very telling.
You know, I got to do a pod about pronunciations because it's true. People really, really get upset. And we get as much mail as, you know, for anything else. I mean, factual inaccuracies be damned. You know, it's the pronunciation is really where it's at for people to get hot under the collar.
I know. Fabia Quist Arkton, who she now works for NPR. She worked for our program years ago, and she's a longtime BBC person. And she used to just go bananas over how we pronounced Kofi Annan, who at the time was Secretary General. She says, coffee, like coffee cup, not Kofi. Coffee, like coffee cup. Kofi Annan, Kofi Annan. We're like, okay, stop. Anyway.
Okay, well, on that note, Carol, it's been great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Patrick.
Let's leave this studio and go for a cup of Kofi Annan, huh?
Absolutely.
You can check out Carol's latest slideshow at theworld.org/cartoons. And there's been more action on annoying Americanisms. The BBC has invited people to write in with their most egregious examples. And the word hate is used a lot to describe them, these examples of American cultural imperialism, even if they're not from America. They ought to be, gosh darn it. I'll post all relevant links, including refutations from linguists, at theworld.org/language. Also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. In fact, I'll post links to all the stories we talked about. And you can post your comments there or at the World in Words Facebook page or tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. The last way you can contact me is by emailing me. That address is language@pri.org. More next week. See you then.